Well, hello, hello. This is the Almaz podcast. My name is Gabriella Love, and I am your host. For those of you who don't know, Almaz is the name of my grandmother. It is an Ethiopian name. Specifically, it is a Sidama name. That is the tribe that I am from. And so I'm, that's the name of the podcast in honor of my grandmother. And of course, by extension, in honor of my ancestors, all of the ancestors that are here with us today. And today we have a very special guest. I am so honored to have him here with us. I am just... You have no idea. I'm so excited to get to talk to him. His name is Trendo, aka Ket Anket. And I'm sure you're going to want to know what Ket Anket means. And I'm going to let him share that with you in just a moment. Before we do that, before we get started, thank you for tuning in. Lots of love, so much love for all of you listening. And I hope you enjoy this episode with Ket Anket. Welcome to the podcast, Ket Anket. Feel free to take a moment to introduce yourself, and with that, also tell us a bit about your name.
Wow. Peace, power, and perpetual life. Ket Anket was a name that was given to me by my elders, my mentors, and it's a Kemetic or ancient Egyptian name that means fire of life.
That is beautiful.
Thank you.
That is truly beautiful. Yeah.
Sidamo, huh?
Say that again.
Sidamo.
Yes, Sidamo. Yeah. Do you know anything about that?
Yeah, it's funny. For some time, I was studying and kind of practicing the Tawahido. Mm-hmm. Most people only know of Ethiopian history, culture, heritage through the Amharic way, through the Haile Selassie. But I'm honored that you kind of reached out to me to do the podcast, and in that same sense to learn a little bit more about the Sidama way as well.
Hmm. Yeah, I wish I could tell you a lot about the Sidama way. I don't know a heck of a whole lot. I wish I knew more about it. But that actually, is a good segue into something that I have found challenging in my personal life and my journey of just discovering myself and discovering the world. I have found it so challenging to learn more about my own ancestry, but like the cultures and traditions of my own being has been a challenge to uncover, because the kinds of tools that I am accustomed to using, like Googling and going to the library, finding books, all these kinds of things. Mind you, things have changed quite a bit since a decade ago. But if we go back to maybe a decade ago, it was really hard to find anything that gave me an insight into African traditions or African ways. And you know what? This conversation about ancient Kemet, it wasn't as mainstream of a conversation 10 years ago as it is now. And so, it's still a process for me. I'm still trying to devour as much as I can that comes my way, because I know that I have this insatiable need for it. Like I yearn to connect with that part of myself. That's a great segue into you, because my impression of you is that you have somehow managed to attract that knowledge to yourself. You've somehow managed to dive into so much of that. And I want to know, how did you do that? How did that happen for you? And, did you find it challenging? Do you still find it challenging? Just tell us about that.
I think that's the amazing thing about us in the diaspora, and when I speak of the diaspora, I mean continental Africans as well. Mm-hmm. Is that here we are, two different cultures, two different parts of the world, two different walks of life, yet we both have that very thing in common, is trying to find ourselves and pick up the pieces, so to speak. one of the things that I've learned to embrace is just that process. A book that I've become very fond of, Mental Nature, Volume 1 by Raoul Nifal Men of the Asar Set Society. He speaks about the body of Asar, or as commonly known via the Greeks, Osiris, having been chopped up in 14 pieces. And Aset, known as Isis, at some point collecting those 14 pieces to put that body back together. And the allegory in that is not just this mythical, is just this mythical being in the physical sense being put back together, but it relates and correlates to so many different aspects of the diaspora. When you talk about identities, you know, we collect those pieces. Here we are, again, different parts of the world, different cultures, different walks of life, collecting those pieces of ourselves individually, collecting those pieces of ourselves and belonging to culture, nation, collectively. You know what I mean? So it's just us, really. I learned to embrace that and accept it because, again, us in the diaspora, that's always something that we're in the process of, in the procedure of undergoing it, is finding ourselves. And here it is, finding that in the story of Asar, the pieces of him are being collected. So it just relates to us in the diaspora in so many different levels. And that I find so beautiful and so intricate. And I've learned to accept that. And I think that in learning to accept that is what has allowed me to, as you say, kind of be a magnet for that type of information. Like, you have no idea. I walk the streets. If I go into a store and I see certain features, I'm like, you're from Nigeria, aren't you? You're from Kenya, aren't you? Oh, I bet you're from Ethiopia, huh? You know what I mean? Like, just always open to receiving that piece of information that may just come along to you in that single moment. You know what I mean? Like, it's a process, you know? And us as in the diaspora, we're a part of that process. And I think that a lot of times we get lost in the frustrations of it rather than devoting our lives to that very process and accepting it and loving it for that matter, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, yeah. Well put, beautifully said. This book that you just mentioned. So you recommended that to me, I think, a couple of days ago, and I've been reading it ever since. And I have to say, every time I sit down to read it, I don't want to do anything else for the rest of it. I want to sit there and continue reading it until I'm done. I have to literally physically remove myself so that I do get other things done, because I just want to eat it and, you know, drink it all up. It's just, it's so good. It's a really good feeling. So how long have you been on this journey of sort of reconnecting with knowledge, you know, out of Africa? And what, you know, take us back to the beginning of that. How did that start for you?
You know, what's funny is I was actually having this conversation with a friend the other day, where I spoke about what I have to kind of mark as a time where I realized, at least in hindsight, that I was on that journey, or I was meant for this journey, or it was just in me, or I was being guided. I remember being about 13 years old, and strangely enough, I remember going to the library and I stole a Quran from the library. Mm-hmm. And I remember just reading it. And it wasn't about Islam. It wasn't about being a Muslim. I knew nothing of that. I just saw the book and was attracted to it because of the aesthetics of it. And just something, I guess, foreign and intriguing and mystic about it. And I remember just going to a family cookout and I was just speaking like the Quran, you know. And again, in hindsight, that's when I feel like it was kind of like a unofficial initiation into mm-hmm. this journey, you know. And just over the years, just really, like you said, finding that time, kind of pulling myself out of society, the everyday norms, the demands of life itself, and picking these books up. I've my family is from Jamaica, Barbados, and then obviously everybody from the Caribbean has some connection to New York. And I just remember going to New York a lot, and you just see it, you feel it.
Mm-hmm.
And just picking these books up. I've been in the Rastafarian community for a great portion of my life, which is I'm so thankful for, because in it I found the teachings. You know, I found Metu Nesha through being in the Rastafarian community. And in fact, I was the type that no matter what I was studying, I didn't accept it wholeheartedly.
Mm-hmm.
So I challenged, not that I challenged it in the sense that this isn't the truth or this isn't, you know, for me. It was just like I was trying to find reason for it. And you will not believe that in the personage of Haile Selassie and what he went through, I found Heru and I found Asar just being played out again. So, that, you know, I learned that it's really like a spiritual, a reoccurring spiritual journey of liberation and spiritual culmination. And it, like you said, I made life itself my book, you know, the same way you attack Metu Nesha. I went through the same thing. And I read that book so many times that I walk life and I'm really like just seeing the book play out. And for that, to answer the question directly, I figured since I was like early teens, just really learning that this is the path that I was set on. And then my mother, you know, her lineage, her heritage, she's part Cherokee, part Jamaican.
Mm-hmm.
So I just remember little things like growing up, my mother used to be like, don't wear too many dark clothes. Bad spirits will jump in you. She didn't want us wearing gold. She would always put sterling silver on us. And when you're a kid, especially growing up in, you know, American culture, to you, that's weird, you
mm-hmm.
know?
But
then it's like as you get older and if you're kind of set along that path and you stay along and you delve deeper into it, you realize that there was something behind that, you know, and that's kind of been my journey as far as the teachings go. Whether I knew it or not, I kind of was already on the journey. I was already undergoing the process.
Yeah. Can I just ask why the silver, not gold?
Well, she used to say that silver cleansed the soul. It cleansed. It was more of a, it had more of a property that drawed the negativity out of a person. And even to this day, I'm sure scientifically there's something there, but the only thing that immediately comes to mind is that you look how gold can potentially corrupt one, you know, and not to say gold itself is bad, but in the society we live in, we put on gold or we look to gold as being some symbol of enrichment and in some cases domination, you know? So if you look at it from like a psychology level, gold is more boastful, whereas silver will keep you humble, you know? That's the only thing immediately that comes to mind is just like, silver doesn't come with the level of status that one will have with gold. You know what I mean? Like a person might look at someone, a person wearing gold would get robbed before a person with silver, you know, stereotypically, you know what I mean? So it just doesn't draw that type of energy, I assume. But I'm sure that more on a more chemical scientific level, you know, silver probably does have some type of cleansing properties to it. Or refining properties.
Yeah. I mean, they both have different properties, so I'm sure there's some sort of effect that's different for both of those. There's a first of all, All of your posts on Instagram are amazing. I love reading it. I love the poetry. I love the work. There's one in particular where you're sort of talking about, you're talking about your journey with Heroes, which is this company that you've built. And there's something, I'm going to read a line to you. And it says, I also remember being apprehensive about posting / sharing because I didn't embody the principles of my own brainchild Heroes. I'd love for you to elaborate on that. And also maybe if you think or feel like this piece of your life where you didn't feel you were embodying those principles, how much of that relates back to kind of growing up in America and in a society that doesn't necessarily represent, our own ancestry, doesn't necessarily, feels maybe disconnected from our diaspora identity. How much of that do you feel plays into this dynamic that happens for probably many of us?
Oh, not to kind of become or play the woe is me, but I feel like it's interwoven into the social fabric of America. One of the questions I always had was, why is it that we're considered African Americans, but we're taught nothing concerning Africa? You go from grade school to college. There's no African language that is especially as people of African descent, us in the diaspora, we're not suggested even to learn anything, especially a language that ties you back. I think it was Chike Anta Diop, and I love that author, his book, Civilizational Barbarism. He posed the statement. He says, non-verbatim, he says, in order for the African-American to break the psychological chains of slavery, he must immerse himself in the language, the culture, and the history of Africa. And we don't get that, at least not on a mainstream level. And I think that's a worldwide thing. I really feel like no matter where you are in the diaspora, you don't get that. Like, you go to school, some of the languages that are offered is I think Mandarin is is offered. Spanish is offered. French was even at one point. I don't know if it still is offered. And you could take those classes in English is offered, and you can take those classes, you get extra credit, they could be, something that helps you carry along in your education or further your education. But how come Swahili wasn't offered? And, if I'm not mistaken, to this day, I think there's over, 800 million, a billion speakers of Swahili, why isn't that offered to us when that is a means of directly connecting ourselves to our ancestral homeland? Why isn't a lot of people don't know that at one point in time, I believe it was during the era where Mussolini had occupied Ethiopia, there was a lot of African-American jet fighters who went over there and fought on behalf of Ethiopia. Why isn't at least the national language of Ethiopia, Amharic? Why isn't that taught? Why are we not? Why is it not promoted? Even to I think it's Babel, or Babel, the learning language app. I downloaded it once. I'm like, okay, yeah, this would be great for me because I don't speak a lot of it, but I speak a little bit of Swahili. I speak a little bit of Amharic. I've studied books. I got dictionaries and all this stuff that I translate on my personal time, but how come this app doesn't promote learning of at least Swahili? It's like institutes that put out like AfricanAncestry.com. I love that idea, and you have us in the diaspora who every day we're finding out who we are through this platform. But it's us that's doing that. We're doing this on our own. It's not any institute that's saying, hey, we're going to sponsor AfricanAncestry.com. The same way you can go get a COVID test, won't you come over here and get your ancestral lineage test? You know, like that's not promoted in mainstream Western, whether it's Europe or America. They don't teach us that. They don't promote that. So, yes, I think we grow up with that sense of not necessarily inferiority, but knowing that we're perceived as having a place and we constantly have to combat against that. I never wanted to post because like most of us, yeah, I grew up with that inferiority complex. I grew up with questioning who I was, how important I was, how much of a scourge I was. And fighting like the rest of us to kind of not have that as a second nature or a second identity. So there was a time where I didn't want to post because I didn't embody that, you know, just going through notions that anybody who's trying to find themselves at time and in a society where you feel like your back's against the wall and you got to fight to establish who. First of all, fight to find out who you are and then fight to have respect in finding out who you are. You know what I'm saying? So, yeah, that plays a big part in it because a lot of times we don't come out the gate with that sense of pride and having that empowerment as a sense of that pride and just knowing who we are, knowing that we don't have to worry about anybody looking down on us or a slight gesture in every day, say a marketplace or at school or whatever, we're not being slighted, you know, we're not being spoken to as if we are less. So that definitely plays a part in, maybe not directly, but definitely indirectly or inadvertently somehow. It's just part of finding yourself, shaking off the frustration and the negativity. And yes, there was a time where I feel like the principles of heroes are so amazing that I didn't embody them. And it's a journey, you know, but again, there was a time where I didn't see it versus now I see it and I don't feel as though it's a fight anymore. It's mine. You know what I mean? I don't have to prove this to anybody. I just have to live it. I just have to be it. It's mine. I don't have to give it back. I didn't borrow it. I didn't steal it. It's mine. And it is a journey and I'm thankful for it, you know, so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's beautiful. It's it brings me back to the irony of it all, that this isn't a journey of discovery. It's a journey of recognition.
Right.
We're increasingly recognizing who we are and what we have, and we're not, you know, it's not a process of finding different pieces and then going, oh, this makes sense or this fits me. We're finding pieces that help us and empower us to recognize what's already there. And what's already there is already beautiful and it's already powerful and supreme and all of these wonderful things.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So what are the principles of heroes? Give us a lowdown of these principles.
All right. So the principles are my personal keys of transformation. I've taken my journey and I've kind of abbreviated it with these principles. You know, you master the forces, you trust your inner process. A lot of times we hear this term, trust the process, trust the process, trust the process. And yeah, we have to trust it. But first and foremost, we have to have an idea of what it is. And it's more of anything in the inner process. You know, it's not just, oh, you go through something and just put trust in it. It's really you come out. I always tell people, you're not who you are and where you are because of went through. You're who you are and where you are because of how you were when you went through those things. So you might have people who went through traumatic experiences in life and one is still a negative, toxic person. And the next one just has this beautiful, majestic, perception or heightened level of perception of things, because they maintained that while they went through it. And it was all about the perception of what they were going through. You know, so I always say, you master the forces because they're here. We're always going to go through these kind of splashings. I like to imagine being in a sea, and energy is other waves instead of actual physical water. And they're always going to be there. There's always going to be these thrashings and splashings. You have to master those forces, you know, and kind of quote unquote walk on water and have perception of this process and understand that it's so much about you that it's not even funny. It has nothing to do with anybody else. It's all about how you perceive it. So you have to trust your inner process, increase your soul voltage. And I believe that we talk about heaven and hell, and whether you're Christian, Buddhist, Hindu, you're studying the Austerian path or the Kemetic path or whatever it is, whether you believe it's heaven within yourself, without yourself, wherever, you have to increase your soul voltage, because ultimately it's the weight of your soul that gets you into this concept of heaven or hell. You know what I mean? You build your edifice. You know, your edifice is it's your own personal heavenly structure. You know, it's I like to think that the place that you internally build while you're here is the place that you build when you pass on. A story that one of my mentors told me, or kind of analogy, was like, the child asks, "Where do we go when we die?" And the parent answers, the same place you go. It's almost like going to sleep. That's why it's good. That's why it's very valuable that you do, or important and imperative that you do good things while you're awake, because when you go to sleep, you don't have bad dreams, you know? So you kind of build your own edifice, you build your structure, you build your complex system of beliefs when you pass on. And in the same sense, while we're here, we're building that our edifice. We're building the world that we live in. You know, we're responsible for that immediately. Not our politicians, not our governors, not our president, not anybody else but ourselves. You are responsible for the structure and the complex systems of ideas, beliefs that you want to live in. You know, and you awaken your purpose and realize your function. You know, our purpose is within all of us. It's sitting there dormant like a seed, and it's up to us to nourish it. You know, and realizing your function is, okay, you might have a purpose in life, but and I think that's the problem with a lot of us, is that we subdue to our ego because we don't know how we function in the grand scheme of things. We don't know our function in the grand scheme of things. A lot of times we know we're great. We just don't know how we want to be great. And I think that that's a big problem amongst us, you know, our American youth, especially our Black American youth, because we know we're great. We have no other choice but to believe that we're great. We just don't know, and being great, what our function is to be. You know, mine's, I had to realize, was, you know, poetry, was mysticism, was anything that kind of my function. You know, and that's what I've noticed is that when I enriches my life, but enriches everybody else's life, and that's my function in life. You know, is enrichment, spiritual culmination, lifting the veil towards that. You know, and I love it. I do. I love it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was beautiful. That was beautiful. So you've got, I'm just going to repeat it back so I know. You've got trusting the process, that internal process.
Trust your inner process, trust and perception of the inner process. Mm-hmm. Master the forces that we find ourselves, master the forces that underlie, integrate, and direct our lives. Trust and perception of your inner processes. Increase your soul voltage. Build your edifice. Awaken your purpose and realizing your function.
Mm-hmm. Beautiful, beautiful. I'm keeping that tagline of the increasing your soul voltage. I've never heard anybody say that. That is that is just boss level speech.
And that's what I mean. You know, that's what I mean is like a lot of the stuff, just like some of the clothing that I design, it's you're not gonna see it on anybody else. It's one of one, and that's not saying, you know, I'm this or beating my chest. We all have that. We all possess that, you know, and that's just the God that exists. That's the power and principle that exists within all of us. It's just awakening to it. And I think that it comes with, like you said, a lot of sacrifice. I ignored a lot, you know, to delve deeper into myself and draw this out of myself. And it just got to a point where I'm ready to share it. You know, it has no other purpose other than to be shared. You know, so I'm glad that you see it and you appreciate it, and it does resonate with you. You know, this is what we're here for. We are here to increase our soul voltage. You know, why believe in anything else than the power of the soul?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love that. I absolutely love that. So let's go. I can talk about mysticism or that kind of stuff for days. This is very exciting topics for me. And I also think, you know, part of why, you know, this podcast or having these conversations is valuable and important is to just to hold space for people to be seen and heard, and also through doing that to allow for other people in the audience to recognize themselves in others and to kind of validate their experiences or just affirm things for them. So that said, I would love to hear, like in your journey in life, what have you found? Well, first of all, I want to preface this with my impression of you is that you are careful not to feed into narratives that disempower us. I think that you are careful not to do that. And that's something that I appreciate. And that's a different conversation altogether, because I find that in this broader conversation of kind of, you know, like, for example, what's been happening with the Black Lives Matter movement throughout 2020, there's this broader conversation that's gotten louder about, you know, reconciling a lot of the pain and the trauma and the wrongdoing and the injustice that still continues to this day. And in that process, something that I have noticed, which for me brings up, you know, an air of concern, is that you can, like, it's easy to get lost in that narrative of that, you know, there's something wrong here, which then turns into I'm a victim of this injustice. And it's easy to get wrapped up in that victim place and forget that the whole point of pointing out injustice is because we're not victims, because we are, you know, we are other than that. The whole point of that is to point it out, because we are just people. So there's just that key piece that for me is something that I've noticed in this kind of broader conversation. And my impression of you is that you're, and correct me if I'm wrong, that you're careful not to feed into narratives that continue to disempower while also doing the right thing or speaking up and speaking out. You can go ahead, but I was just going to ask if just in your journey, what's that experience been like for you, and are there things in your journey that you found most challenging in kind of reconciling these different narratives?
That's a very powerful question based on a very aware perception. It's always walking a fine line. Mm-hmm. Because while the cries of obviously the oppressed are valid. I think that I have a saying, what you fear is a lot less powerful than you believing how powerful what you fear is.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that a resolve-based mind is everything. So while, and when I mean that fine line is, you want to hear people out. And it's almost as if I know if I say this, if at any point I say this, I'm going to be perceived as being unsympathetic, being unable to relate to, and being unable to feel and sense, and in a sense, a sellout. So for the most part, I just keep my mouth closed and I preach empowerment. I don't touch on a lot of political topics, et cetera, because I feel like, what's the resolve? How do you get that resolve? For instance, years ago, there's a book called The Willie Lynch Letter, The Making of a Slave.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody knows about this book.
Mm-hmm.
But there's also the book called Part Two, the breaking of the chains of the Willie Lynch letter, something like that. So, which mm-hmm. means that there's not only is it just the book that tells you how the slave was made and et cetera, et cetera. This is a book about telling you how to get out of that. You know, I'd like to think of myself as a very resolve based, a person who possesses a very resolve based mind, and a person who is forward thinking in the sense of just because something is done to you, it doesn't mean that you have to allow it to overpower, overwhelm, or direct you, you know? So for that reason, yes, I do try not to play into the narrative because I have my own perception of things. I feel like I walk a very fine line because I just know the minute, and it's just my experience, the minute I open my mouth with my perception, it doesn't always go the way that I plan it to go. And mm-hmm. I feel like I'm very much about empowerment, and everybody's not ready for that, you know? And it's kind of like when I look at the sister who had read the poem during the inauguration, beautiful poem,
mm-hmm.
beautiful poem, beautiful sister, beautiful moment. But then it's like a white Dutch female writer wants to or has been chosen to translate the poem into the Dutch language. And now it's an uproar. And it only makes me think about, I remember when Idris Elba was going to play Thor.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was the Norse community. They did not like that. They did not want a black man playing Thor. They said it's unrealistic. And they smashed up movie theaters, et cetera, et cetera. And I remember the rebuttal from both black and white people was, you're saying it's unrealistic, but it's a mythological figure. It's a mythological character. You know what I mean? So we mm-hmm. saw the irony in that, but we don't see the irony in a white Dutch female writer translating a poem that kind of capitalizes that moment of inauguration, which symbolized a great change or a new beginning. And I personally feel like I'm a poet, you know, I honestly would love for anybody and everybody to transliterate, to interpret my work, you know, mm-hmm. And that's the beauty in being an artist is like, once you put your work out there, you really give it to the world. You know, it's not to say that you don't want it to serve the purpose and intent in which you released it for. But I think that her poem symbolizes that great climb towards a change. And how do we embrace that moment in its totality? If indeed it's only it stops at the gates of the Black community. You know what I mean? Like, if we're really talking about that change, then it has to transcend all lines, and we have to be ready for that. You know what I'm saying? Other than that, you're an artist. It's kind of like, remember, I believe in prior to Motown era, they had you had Black singers, and they were kind of only subjected to what was called the Chitlin Circuit. Kind of like how Black baseball players were only in the Black League. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of like now that, you know, not to say that, oh yeah, we made it to the big league because we're over here, but it's transcended that. And that it has transcended that, you got the moment to show how great you are. And how can you do that if you say, I only want it to be in the Chitlin Circuit or back in the Negro League, so to speak. You know mm-hmm. what I'm saying? We're greater, man. Like, you can't hurt us. You can't take anything from us. Why? You know, to me, it's like that came from a place of fear mm-hmm. and insecurity. And I understand that I might get some backlash to that, but that's just how I feel. You mm-hmm. know what I mean? Like, it's poetry, it's art. And if we are that great, what are you afraid of? The truth does not need, the truth doesn't need a shield. It doesn't need someone to defend it. It doesn't need a narrator. It doesn't need a stenographer. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. Like, put it out in the universe, and if it's as truthful, as beautiful, and as immutable as you say it is, no matter what, it's going to be. You know what I mean? Like, we know who Rumi is. We know his background. You can't take that away. You know what I'm saying? But I think that as Black people, kind of like even going back to what you read about my post, it's like we're so used to having things taken away from us. We're so used to having, you know, the things lightened up and canonized, that's where that response came from. Mm-hmm. But kind of have to just be strong enough, ready enough, and bold enough to let it be what it is. And you know, and I think that was a moment where we kind of should have just let it be what it is. Like, nobody can take that from us. Nothing's mm-hmm. going to change that moment. Nothing's going to change who spoke, what was spoken, you know, and that was a moment to just be.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't a moment to fight, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
So mm-hmm. That's been my experience as far as that. But that's something that, you know, you get on social media and you see everybody sharing their experience, and most of it is speaking on the terms of it was a bad thing. And I see a lot of stuff, as much as I want to comment, I just surpass it. I just have to transcend it, because if I don't, it's like you create this enmity between yourself. I don't have that type of platform where I can say something and majority of people, one, that it matters, and then two, majority of people are going to listen no matter how contradicting it is to what they're saying. You know mm-hmm. what I'm saying? Well, I, for the most part, like I said, I've learned to just keep my mouth closed and put forth what I want to put forth. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, I'm glad to be having this, you know, kind of conversation with you. Because for me, I think it all boils down to awareness, you know, awareness of what we're doing, when we're doing it, and why we're doing it, and how we're doing it. And I think there's room for anger. There's room for sadness. Because like all of those are valid responses to a lot of the things that have gone on in the past and continue to go on. And not just, you know, with the Black community, but, you know, just in the world in general, there's plenty of things on this planet that would make a person feel angry.
Right.
I don't think, you know, I think that's a perfectly natural response. The way it shows up for me, and I'll try and paint a picture for you, is I imagine sort of, let's use myself as an example. I imagine myself as kind of standing upright, you know, in my full, I don't know, appearance galore, whatever. I'm just standing upright in all of my glory with dignity and all this stuff. And that's the reality. That is the baseline default reality of me, my presence. And then there's the experience of being. I'll continue to paint this picture. So there's me standing upright, and then there's me. There's another version of me that's sort of bent over, much closer to the ground, and is kind of trying to look up, you know, having trouble, almost like trying to look up, but the head feels like it's being held down by something. And that version of myself is an experience that is an extension of like the traumas and the conditioning and the, you know, societal ideas and ideologies that are floating around, the restrictions, all of these things that are inherited either on a personal level or collectively. Those are, they're creating that experience for me. I'm creating that experience for myself with all of those like different elements. But that is not the reality. That's a perceived experience. That is like that version of me thinks that that's reality and is experiencing things from that perspective. But it's not reality. And so for me, when I find myself, and I've been, you know, in many periods of my life where I was doing this, and when I find myself highly engaged in trying to get myself out of that oppressive state, mm-hmm. what I'm doing is I'm actually playing in this illusion of who I am. I'm playing in this arena of a perceived reality, because the reality is that I'm already standing upright. I'm already dignified. I'm already in all of my glory. And, you know, that doesn't require me to work to make that happen. It doesn't require anything of me. That's just my default. And so like for me, being aware of that and accepting that my truth is already dignified brings up this question of, okay, when I am engaging or I'm making a certain decision, am I doing it from a place of trying to remove oppression from my experience, or because I believe that that's the reality of what's occurring, or am I simply, for example, pointing out an injustice from the reality of I am in a dignified place. I'm already standing upright. So I'm no longer that person. I am the real me. Did that paint the picture?
Yeah, absolutely. The first thing that comes to mind is always the opposite yet complementary forces that exist in all things. I think it's physics to have the two components of a wave and crest. That's the craft of life. You know, the wave is high and it's spiking, it's peaking. Rather, and then you have the crest, which is low, and it seems like it's in a descent, you know. So I think that's the beauty in living, is that here it is, you have this form that is wild, it's always trying to break free. The soul is always trying to break free, yet it's bound by this flesh, you know, and then you have some the perception of some mystical or spiritual texts would speak about how the soul is beautiful and it's light and it's ethereal, and then the body is trash and it comes from dirt. So there's always going to be like this quote unquote battle and struggle between quote unquote light and dark, good and bad, flesh versus the soul, and it's almost like it is both individual and it is collective. However, it may seem different as person to person, and then through ethnic groups, culture to culture, and then based on what you go through from psychology to psychology, that is our own personal and collective and therefore universal dialectic materialism. You know, we're always in a state of our protons and a neutron, protons and neutrons, however those may be become synonymous to other components of our life. They're always just crashing into each other and exploding, but that something is always being created. The point is turning our perception to, regardless of what I go through, regardless of how I feel, how do I constantly turn this into a learning experience for myself, and a learning experience is turned into a better version of me, you know? So I don't see anything wrong with that. You know, I see that as, a person, an experience that we all, whether we show it or not, we're always in that. And again, you know, it's like our own personal dialectic materialism. We have two different perspectives always colliding to create something different, you know. Mm-hmm. And you see that in everything. You see that in everything. When they talk about Heru and Set, or Horus and Set, it's like it's just two opposite yet complementary forces. It seems like they're external beings, but they really, that's what's going on with us day in and day out. You know, that is the gist of why we're here. You know, where would we be without those opposite yet complementary forces, perspectives, and perceptions constantly colliding? If, like, we would have very mundane lives if we didn't have that internal struggle, you know, and therefore we wouldn't have any resistance to our beauty. And in any resistance to our, and on the other side, you know, vice versa, no resistance to the ugliness that exists within, or the darkness, and we wouldn't have any growth. You know, our universe is growing every day. Scientists have concluded that our universe grows every day. You know, so it's the same thing with, you know, mastering those forces and trusting that inner process. Once those are embedded within us, no matter where we go, what we do, what we experience, all of our experiences, good or bad, will be sacrifices to a greater version of ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's the process, you know? Mm-hmm. That's the process.
That's the process. That's the process. I'm with you. Have you done a DNA test with AfricanAncestry.com?
No, but I definitely plan on it. I absolutely definitely plan on it.
Yeah, do it. I've done it, and it was definitely interesting for me. Interesting because so I'll just tell you about it. So because I'm a woman, of course, I can only trace my maternal lineage. In order to trace the paternal lineage, as women, we need either a father or a brother. And so, according to AfricanAncestry.com, maternally, I have learned, they traced it back to most similar to modern day Tuareg people. Many of them are currently in Mali, I think, if I'm not mistaken. But anyway, the Tuareg people is a semi-nomadic desert tribe that kind of trickled down from North Africa at some point. And I thought that was really, really interesting because I've been to Morocco and I've been to the desert, and I looked around and I thought, wow, I look like the people here. You know, these people look like me. I was a little confused by it. But it was also enlightening. So discovering that really opened up this curiosity for me of, like, you know, at what point did people go from there to Ethiopia? And like, how did that, like, what does that migration pattern look like? And how much of that has been happening throughout Africa? I imagine, like, my assumption is it happened quite a bit. And there's a lot of overlap in different tribes across the continent. But I'd love to know, like, what your thought, if you've come across, you know, any specific things that have given you insight into, like, migratory patterns across the continent. And if you have, please feel free to share that.
Well, it was a book I read years ago, The Biggest Secret by David Icke. He said, if you want to follow corruption, you follow the money. If you want to know the lineage or track of a people, you follow the language. If you look at the Zulus of South Africa, you wouldn't off the back know that Swahili is a Bantu based language. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? The people of Ghana, I believe, is it Ghana? I speak Vai. Vai is, I believe, written in Persian. You know what I mean? So when you talk about the Tuareg, those are people who, there's another term for it. It's so funny because it's mentioned in Metu Netra as well. It's another term for they're like quasi nomadic, so to speak, where mm-hmm. they have a base, but they move around a lot. Mm-hmm. You know, that's what we did. There were books out there that came before Columbus, the Nubian people of, the Sudan, Ethiopia, that region. They were in Central and Southern America. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. The Olmecs were considered Nubian people. The Toltecs were considered Nubian people. We moved around. We migrated, especially after and during the advent of Islam, where a number of us trekked from East Africa to West Africa. You know, so this is why you see these quote-unquote Hebrewisms the seemingly replicated forms of social and religious structure in different cultures and religions. Why are they in both East and Africa, regardless of how they differ, pantheons of gods? You know, because these were power and principles, archetypes that we carried, and depending on where we went, they had to change. You know, there's no lions in North America. So we look towards the panther, you know what I mean? Like, or the jaguar. That was the most powerful cat in North America. We didn't have lions in North America. So then look at the natives, the wolf, very, very significant, animal in that culture, you know? So it's like, we moved around, we taught, we still communicated, we knew our home base, but we traveled, we explored, you know? So, it doesn't surprise me. It doesn't surprise me. They speak about the Australians, you know, having a descendant, even though a lot of times they don't like to talk about it, they don't like to, you know, admit to it, having some ancestry in Africa. Look at the Moors, you know, the Moors ruled what, Spain for 700 some odd years. And then look at the Spanish who colonized, Latin America, and you just look at the language, you know, mm-hmm. al, you know, al and el. El is a definitive article in Spanish. It's also a definitive article in the Hebrew language, you know, and it's there. It's just devoting time, energy, and opening up our minds to these not even possibilities, just realities, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And finding being more congregative minded than segregative minded, you know? And we'll find them, and those doors will open because it's endless, it's timeless.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Absolutely. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. It's been such a wonderful conversation with you. It's been really nice to have you on the podcast, launching this. I think the energy that you've brought today, and this is what I truly believe, is exactly what it needed. And it's going to be the anchor for what this podcast is going to end up unfolding as. So thank you, Ket Unket. Thank you for a great conversation. I would love it if you closed off with a poem.
All right. This is actually called American Mythology. Mm-hmm. And I think it's something that it fits. And I love the podcast. So again, it's an honor. I kind of feel like I'm at home here. So I'm totally in awe and appreciated, and our ancestors are smiling. I think they love these moments. So I'll share this with yourself and with your listeners. Called American Mythology. How do we survive in a land where the sun refuses to rise? It only sets. In such strange ways, we remember our African precepts. The elders taught us the power of harmonic equations. Now we play to the gallery for affirmation. Dancing simply because the floors are covered with fire in this hell. Our masks have become ways and means of being other than ourselves. The oppressed, suppressed, depressed, and repressed possessed of ancient spirits who know not the concept of death. Incarnations of Persephone, Sisyphus, Tantalus, as long as the hells of Europe influence us, Aset, Peru, Djedhuti, who will always be the condemned presence of American mythology. The aborted children of this forsaken nation, ill-begotten from the land of Netcher, hurled into this world, man's potential will remain curled in fetal position, swimming in the river of a blind god's disposition. Our fathers never seem to listen. Our mothers emulate the tensions of a sophist's mind state. And so the prophetic inscription of the seers unfold, seeds of a potential fate dismembered. We are the tales of old. I wonder if the calls of their ancestors haunt them, or is it they alone who know freedom, peace, by having no recognition of them? We are alchemists with only our souls to work with, manipulating the remembrances of the incidents of our lives. Even in our ignorance, we are transcendentalists. My, how powerful the will to survive.
Mm. Wow, I've got goosebumps. That's awesome. Wow. Yeah, wow. Well, thank you, thank you, thank you. Yeah, thank you.
Thank you, thank you, thank you. And again, more than just a salutation, more than just a peace, power, and perpetual life, you know, do not stop, keep going. Believe, plant the seed, step forth. See those lines connecting between yourself and whatever it is, your vision, and constantly feed like a child still attached to an umbilical cord. This is the power we have. This is the power you have, you know. And that's it, it's yours, it's ours. Let's make this happen, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yes, yes. Oh my, oh my, oh my. That was our very first episode of the Almas podcast. That was Ket and Ket, aka Trento. I just, man, that last poem, just goosebumps. And those last words, more goosebumps. I mean, I had goosebumps a couple of times throughout the episode, but so grateful to have had him on to get us started on this journey, and so grateful for the words of blessings that he left behind. I highly recommend that you check him out. I will leave links in the description, of course. You're going to want to check out his poetry. You're going to want to check out his art. You're going to want to check out his expression, because it is absolutely beautiful. And on top of that, really, like for me, what stands out the most is just this wealth of knowledge and awareness of different things that for me are very exciting, because like I've mentioned a couple of times, it's been challenging to connect to African traditions of mysticism and spirituality. And so for me, it means a lot to have someone somewhere to go for more of those kinds of resources. Yeah, that was it for the first episode of the Almas podcast. A shout out to everyone listening. Shout out to friends, loved ones. Shout out to our ancestors. Yes, they are smiling. Yes, they are happy this is happening. They are celebrating with us. They're here with us. And shout out to Ket and Ket, of course. Thank you for tuning in. Please do share this far and wide. Let's amplify these voices. Let's amplify each other. And hey, let's do this not just for ourselves, but for our ancestors too. With lots and lots of love from me to you. Check you next time. This was the Almas Podcast.